This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Welcome to this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the podcast that launches itself into outer space. My name is Mark McGee, and today we are going to be talking about booster rockets, which I will elaborate on momentarily. But I've got two designers here who have their heads in the stars. Daniel Solis, say hello to everybody.
Hello to everybody.
And we have T.C. Petty. Hello, T.C.
Hi, I'm T.C. Petty the third.
All right. The topic we will be talking about in a little bit is booster rocket. Now, this is something that Daniel and I happened to just speak about kind of randomly one day about games that we've spent time on designing or developing or something like that, really did play a critical role in getting us where we are as designers, but not by getting published. So they're not like our designs that everybody sees and knows us for. I want to get to that in just a second. But first, tell me something good. What is something that's good that's happening, or some news or updates or anything? Who's got something?
I guess the big news since I've been on the show is that I have a new gig working for WizKids as the art director on their board games division. So that's basically taken up all of my time and that I would have been devoted to development and design and stuff. So you may not have seen as many games from me lately, but trust me, I've got my hands all over a bunch of other games coming out of WizKids over the next like year or two. Yeah, so that's good.
That is good.
And I guess I'm in a similar space. Daniel is doing the graphic design space and everything, but I'm kind of in the development space still with Renegade Games. And what's cool, though, something good, is that I just came back from a retreat from San Diego with the Renegade people, and it was super fun. But also, I got to play my father's work, which I've been working on for years for with all the Renegade people, got feedback, and now things are rolling pretty hardcore. So that will be a good thing, and hopefully I'll have more news about that later on in the year, and it'll be super good, and I can't wait. It's been a long time working on a board game and an app at the same time.
Oh, nice.
Gosh. I bet you have a couple of booster rockets that have led you to this point already, huh?
Yes, and that's why this is a good subject, because both of you, I think Mark said nicely, that we've both been doing this for a while, and maybe not for our entire lives, but like doing this kind of game design stuff for a while, and that gives us a lot of failures to talk about, and that's great.
Yeah, I did specifically want to get some people who had enough experience that you would be certain to have at least a couple of things you could point out as booster rockets. But speaking of something good and very closely related to potentially booster rocket zone. So I've
I'm thrown out of game.
I for the longest time I've been working on like a couple games and pitching them and getting them good and ready. I made a decision that I was gonna at least for the time being, you know, move on to some other games. At a couple of the conventions I went to in the second half of last year, I was like, hey, these are going to be my last conventions, like proactively pushing on these really hard. They're good games. I like where they are. But if they haven't caught on by the end of the year, you know, they haven't been picked up by anybody or had some plan done with them, then what I will do, I just chose to make the decision that I will move on to other games for a while, partly so I can do other things, maybe get a fresh perspective, maybe after like a year or two, if I need to revisit them, I have that option. Or if I choose to never, then oh well, it happens. But yeah, so the decision to move on and do different things has been neat, and I've already started working on a couple other games. I feel like I have this like capacity of actively working on two games at once is about my my limit, and I have to like put stuff away for a while if I'm going to do anything else. But I've already picked up two other projects that I'm working on, and I'm engaged and excited about both of them. So it's good. I'm enjoying it. That's my good thing.
I don't even know what the metaphor is for that, as opposed to booster rockets. Rockets that got you there, but then fell off, and
yeah.
I don't know, decoupled. But I have a few of those too. So it's like booster rockets and also like, fell back down accidentally.
As we move on to the main topic, let's flesh out this analogy just a little bit, both for fun and also to maybe give us a starting off point. Because like, so booster rockets, I'm no rocket scientist, but,
but
my understanding, so if you have more rocket familiarity than I am, than I have, if anything I say sounds incorrect, but is not funny, then you can correct me. So booster rockets, they're these big rocket engines that are usually strapped on to the back or the side of a rocket. And then when a blast off in outer space, you know, they just shoot really hard. And once it gets like really high, they've already spent their fuel. And so they just kind of fall off and like descend back to the planet. They never get to see all the aliens out there. They just stay in their atmosphere. And then the cool part of the rocket goes up and has adventures. That's it, right?
Sure.
Yeah, you're.
Yeah. Close okay. enough.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
That's a layman's understanding of rocket science and booster rockets. Mm-hmm. And so then we can at least use that as our metaphorical model for the sort of thing we're talking about. Things mm-hmm. that got you there, but never saw the aliens.
You're very fixated on the alien part of this.
Okay, they didn't get to explore the wild unknown. No one knows you for the pieces of your rocket that just fell back to the Earth. They know you for the orbiting modules.
Yep.
Well, so how about this then? Are these booster rockets, as we're calling them, are they failures? Or, I mean, is that just a nice thing to call failures so we can feel good about not failing?
Part of it, sometimes things are booster rockets and you know it from the start. Those are the easy ones to say that those are not failures because you didn't expect them to make it to orbit in the first place. I think we at the guild, whenever we have a meeting and we have a prototype and we don't know, for example, like a final scoring condition, and we just sort of pick one randomly, like a triangular scoring system and making a set collection thing of that out of that. And just saying, okay, I'm going to tell how these tiles go together, and let's just assume for the time being that the scoring condition is just this triangular scoring system. It's not going to be the final thing. We're just doing that to test out the mechanics. Boom, that is in a sense a booster rocket because it's never going to make it to the final published version of the game, but okay. It'll definitely get you there because you need something on the table for people to grab a hold of if the test is going to move forward.
Ah, so that's even a smaller scale than I was maybe even initially thinking. Like a part of a game that you know is not going to be the real thing that you're just using as a placeholder, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. I think we've all had a little bits of that where we just need to get something on the table, and so we kind of hand wave one part of the game.
Okay, that sort of thing like apply even at a larger scale. Like you start working on a game. Like, so rather than just like a placeholder scoring system, kind of to piggyback off of your example, it's like a full game, you know, you worked on it for like a couple weeks and you're like, yeah, this is a game. Then you're like, well, okay, we played it a few times. It will probably never get published. Like the whole thing itself. Is that also a booster rocket potentially, or is that just something else?
Yeah. I have one story in particular to that I've had a small card game, actually a couple of small card games that I self-published, never really hit it big, never transitioned into like a mainstream publisher thing. But at the same time, I nevertheless learned a lot about just basic design by testing out on a small scale some ideas that I had. And some of those ideas would go on to be incorporated into things like Junk Orbit or Kodama. And Though those initial games never, you know, hit it big and never got a huge audience, I wouldn't have had my successes unless I had gone through those initial games first.
And are those, and you're including, are you including games that are even published too?
Oh, I mean, like I said, they come in all different sizes, like from like throwaway mechanics to games that that were self-published, and kind of in the middle are things like I've got a huge graveyard of prototypes that like I just kind of abandoned because I lost interest or I learned that there was a certain, for example, I have a habit of, at least a while back, I had a habit of incorporating too many set collection elements into a single game, and then realizing at a certain point after testing a prototype for a couple different ways, a couple different times, that there's like a maximum cognitive threshold for set collection that most players have, and so that was an important lesson, even though that game never even got self-published. It's just good to know that for the future.
So if we extended the metaphor further, could we do stage one, stage two, stage three?
Oh, sure.
Even like stage...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
But I mean, what are they, like burns? Should we use them like burn? I mean, stage one is going to be like your easy mechanics, right? And stage two is going to be like something that you made but threw away. And then stage three is like even almost completed games or even published games that you just feel like were a good stepping stone towards something. I mean, I don't know if we could extend it even further. I don't know, because burns are like this too. Burns confuse me because I don't know which way they're supposed to go. I think, isn't it three? A third degree burn is the worst one.
Oh, I thought you were still talking about rockets because they caught.
No, I know the rockets work the other way, but like burns, I always get confused with burns as to which way they go. Is a third degree burn bad?
Higher is bad.
So like a fourth degree burn, it's just you've been engulfed in flames and you're dead.
I'm not sure that exists because you're often dead with third degree, but not always.
Okay, but it does go the opposite way.
It does.
So we're not talking about things burning. We're talking about rockets. Okay, I just want to make sure because now that I'm thinking about it.
I could bore you with the actual terminology, but yeah, the suffice it to say that first stage is the first rocket, and second stage is the second rocket, and so on. It rarely gets to the third stage because third stage is what usually gets you into orbit.
Okay, so I've only played Kerbal Space Program for a little bit, so I don't know all the stages.
I mean, it's further complicated because usually there's more than one first stage booster.
This is complicated.
No, but it's great because now you can put everything you want in stage one and stage two and stage three, and it's just a severity level. And then you have your beautiful, beautiful game that is the rocket ship that takes you into outer space and does all the cool stuff.
This does tie into the typical advice that we hear a lot of about like trimming things away and you know, killing your darlings, so to speak. And I think the reason I adopted this metaphor of booster rockets instead of killing your darlings is partly because when you're first starting out and you hear this advice, whether it's in writing or in game design, it's pretty brutal, especially if you're working on your first game and you're not confident that you'll ever have a second game, and someone's coming in here and telling you, yep, forget everything about that game and kill that darling and this thing you love so much, forget that. It's very cynical, and it doesn't immediately imply that there's a forward momentum to that act that I think the rocket metaphor helps with a little bit. And granted, it's not a perfect metaphor either, but at least it feels more goal oriented, that it's not just destructive for destruction's sake.
No, I think that's the interesting part. Like this one is more of like a positive progression, because I've heard I think we've all heard it at this point, the idea of failing faster. You know, mm-hmm. And the problem I have, and I know that there is a fail faster journal that exists that helps you write down and hopefully recognize the problems that you have in your game, because I think that's the biggest issue. If you're first starting out, like if someone just tells you to, oh, well, fail faster, just get it to the table and do stuff, that doesn't help. It's not like you're going to recognize when something's bad. Even if someone tells you this part I don't like as much, you might just say to yourself, well, I mean, I just need to fix it a little bit, right? I don't need to get rid of it. And you're not going to know, like, how can someone who's brand new know when they've failed and when they just need a little adjustment. You know, it's really tough. So I like the rocket booster metaphor because it kind of helps you like trim and feel like maybe, okay, this was a good idea, but now I can, maybe this one's a little bit better, you know? And that to me sounds a little bit more palatable than just telling someone, oh, you should fail. That's good. Because you don't know when you failed.
Let me tell you a short anecdote about what this reminds me of. So I had one of my earliest designs when I was in the guild. Some of you may remember it was Five Elements, and it had some dice in it. I guess the special thing about it was the dice, in addition to sometimes rolling them, you know, you could actually like rotate them, and there's like a circular progression that gets through all the faces. So sometimes you roll them, sometimes you progress them through the faces. And I worked on that for a while. You know, it had been evaluated by some publishers. Some of them were, you know, thinking about some changes. It went through several different iterations over a span of time. Ultimately, it never ended up getting published. I no longer work on it. I decided that it didn't really have what a game needs in order to be a game that I would be satisfied with. It's not a game that I work on anymore. But over the course of all that time spent on it, you know, I learned a lot about, you know, how do you use dice in a game that feels good and makes sense? I learned about, you know, what are some ways that, you know, kind of a hard to understand mechanic can be presented in a way that makes it easier to follow? What are some things that function similarly, but have different levels of how quickly you can learn them? Things like that, which all those lessons are useful even today. And any of the other successes I've been having, many of them come from a lot of lessons learned from that one game that will never be published. That's kind of like, when I think about it, that's an example that I would say probably counts for me as a booster rocket. Cause it really, like, through that, you know, cause I pitched it places, that was the beginning of some of my friendships with some people at, you know, publishing companies and, you know, connections with other designers. I took that to several unpubs. So I made several friends and connections with that game. So my time spent working on that game was absolutely worth it in terms of making me a better designer, making me a more connected designer, you know, meeting some people that I really like knowing and just having better design skills. But that game itself is never going to get published. No one's ever going to see it. And, you know, I may not ever work on it again. And that's okay. And it was worth it. And it's led to greater things, you know, like outer space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I imagine every major artist has just piles of sketchbooks, and those sketchbooks don't get hung up in galleries or anything because they're practice, and they're the artifact of an improving craft.
And I would say honestly, like to what you're saying about early games that like inspire you, a lot of times, even if it wasn't a specific game, I would have mantras or phases. And so one of my earliest phases I'll talk about, like, is, and I have a lot, so I have a lot of abandonware from my early phases of, like, design. And I think that makes sense. My hit percentage of, like, things that hit, if they're larger games, are, like, much better now. But it used to be that pretty much everything was just throwawayable. I was very critical of myself. But phases-wise, I had this thing where I would always be like, I don't like dice. I don't like cards used this way. I'm going to make a card game or a dice game that fixes it so that I like it, right? Like, I would have this thing where I would just take a mechanic and be like, I don't like that mechanic. I'm going to fix it. And I did that for, like, years. And what I found out about that is that while that is kind of fun to explore, there's a reason why people like these things, and they're unrelated to just completely subverting that thing. Like, a die is fun to roll. And if you take away the fun aspect of rolling a die, it's no longer that fun. Now, I might like it. and don't get me wrong, like, games that are bigger, like larger games where the dice, like Panamax, right? You roll them. I mean, I guess you do still get to roll them, but like, you roll them and they stay that way forever.
Yeah,
they're not changing. I'm okay with that. It's one of my favorite games, but I'm okay with that. It's just that, like, you kind of can't go in. Like, I don't think they went into making Panamax saying, you know what, we hate dice. Let's just roll them once and then just keep them on the table. You know, like, I don't think that was the mantra. And so I learned to get over that. And whenever I kind of evolved out of, I hate this, let's fix it, I got better as a designer. But at the same time, like, knowing that information helps me go back in time and be like, yeah, that was a dumb thing to be thinking about. I should probably get out of that phase. But also, it helps me recognize, because other designers get into that phase too. I've seen other designers do that phase, and get out of that phase as fast as you can. Don't be like me.
When you see other designers going through, this is a thing I run into sometimes too, is that I'll spot some patterns that I had to go through in other designers as they're early in their career. And I hate to be like the old man and saying, when I was your age, or when I was at your stage. When you're young or new, you're not going to listen to that. Clearly, you know better. So, to your point, if someone had come to you when you were in one of these phases, if older TC traveled back in time and warned you about the future, Marty, like, would you have listened, or would you have just had to do it yourself to really get that lesson in?
So that's the thing about me. I may have listened because I'm an old soul. I know that. I just have this weird, like, even since I was like really young, I just had a very like lackadaisical attitude towards things. And so, like, when someone would say that, if someone would come to me, and especially after getting over the initial shock of someone from the future coming back and talking to me, and it's myself, I'd probably be like, oh, yeah, you know, you're probably right. Like, why would I sit here and be sarcastic and float around here? I need to get out of the 90s and push forward. So maybe me, but totally. But at the same time, like, what would I have done instead? I don't know. I probably would have just been, like, listless for a while going, man, why did he tell me that? I don't know what to do now. My whole game design career is down the tubes. It helps to recognize these. I think even talking about it, right? I mean, even if someone was listening to this podcast for the very first time, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for listening. Also, they're probably going to recognize it a little bit better now. And I wish I had that. Like, that's all I needed. Like, I needed a podcast that told me, oh, hey, guess what? I used to do this thing where I would, like, dice are bad. I'm just going to make a dice game. Ha, ha, ha. And get over it. Get over yourself. Like, I probably would have got over it much faster, and maybe would have progressed faster. And I think, honestly, the amount of information that's out right now far exceeds the stuff that I had 12 years ago, 13 years ago when I was starting doing this. You know,
geez, has it been that long?
It has. No, and see, that's the thing. So, it, just as a history thing, like, you know, it's like I knew Daniel Solis from early Kickstarter stuff in like 2011. And, you know, that's like the sort of weird deep respect that I've had for Daniel Solis throughout these years. But thinking about like how short of a time that is, that's not very long, honestly, like 10 years.
No.
Yeah. So it's like, even though I've been working on this stuff for like 12, 13 years, and you probably, I don't know how much further would you say about the same amount of time or?
My first game design blog was, I think, out in like 2001, 2002. Ooh,
wow. Yeah, that beats me.
Talk about booster rockets. I had a whole era for about, say, 5 years where I only designed two-player abstracts. Because yes. I had this philosophy that came out of art school of, I think it's like 100 pounds of clay. It's a classic story it's from The Art of Fear. If you probably heard of this book as well, but in The Art of Fear, there's a story about this pottery class where this professor splits up the class and tells one half that their goal for the end of the semester is to just make 100 pounds of pots. And the other half of the class, their goal is to make a perfect pot. And lo and behold, the class that just has the goal of quantity ends up making the quality, and the half that is focused on the quality gets obsessed and lost in the weeds and never ends up actually making a single pot, or at least that one that was as good as if they had just gone ahead and done it. This is an old story. and those of us who've been around a while are very familiar with it. And ultimately, that's what leads to the whole fail faster model. That's what leads to now what we're talking about in the booster rockets. And the spirit of it is the same all these years later. It's just practice makes perfect. This is not a new idea. I think in this case, though, it's what helps is recognizing when the work you're doing is practice. Sometimes it means you don't recognize it in the moment. Sometimes you recognize it after the fact that this was practice for something else that came later on. And just realizing that though in retrospect, what work you had been doing now comes to light as being practice for something else rather than being the work itself, it's still valuable and it still got you to where you are. And you probably wouldn't have made it to where you are without it.
Yeah, the idea of practicing game design is really interesting because I did game development in grad school. So I actually, there were legitimate, here are practice exercises. There was that thing. But once I finished with that, I didn't purposefully do any exercises that were practice exercises. You know, I made all these games that were bad because they were early games and stuff. Yeah, just crazy stuff. Stuff where you like build a map and explore with ships. That was like a massive economic game that didn't really work. And you learn a bunch of stuff that doesn't work. But I didn't on purpose do practice. But I did get a lot of practice in because I was making a bunch of stuff that its main benefit to me was that, yeah, now I know something that I didn't know. I explored some of the subtleties about how systems like this function. I now know something about exploration on a hex grid because I've tried building a game that has exploration on a hex grid. I guess everything is practice until it wins. It's like it's almost like cheating. You get to choose which design is the actual one that counts. Yeah. Out of all the ones that you have and the other ones you just, oh yeah, that one doesn't count. That one was practice.
mulligan.
But yeah, that's fascinating. And in other fields that I have hobbies in, one thing that does benefit me is trying a breadth of different things. Because if there's like one aspect of that hobby that I really like, I can actually, yeah, I get better at it by doing more of that specific thing. But I also get better at it by doing things adjacent to it. For instance, so I play the trumpet, but I also have a drum set that I found somewhere. And I've been banging on the drum set and just practicing banging on the drum set. You know, I actually hear things differently now when I'm playing the trumpet because I've also had to hear what myself playing the drums sounds like. I also, you know, I sing at church, and the more that I sing, because I sing bass, believe it or not, and which is a different part than the trumpet is. So having to like sing tonics in harmonies gives you a different perspective on how, you know, a treble instrument would play. So like these things that are adjacent to that skill also make me better at that skill. And I feel like in game design, it's very similar. There are lots of things. Any game that has a dice in it could teach you something about how to use dice in a game that works for another game that has dice in it. Or it might tell you why you should not have dice in a different game. And then all those things, especially if no one ever hears about them or sees about them, those are all, yeah, booster rockets. They get you this extra information, this extra knowledge and insight and ability and skill that you wouldn't have had if you didn't do them. But if you didn't do them, you wouldn't be in outer space.
With the aliens.
Yeah. Yes, talking to the aliens. I just wanted to say real quick about that, like, sometimes I'll force myself to do like a design challenge, and I think that's like helpful. I think a lot of people should just do those design challenges that are out there for you, because those can be real quick booster rockets. They don't even have to, like, honestly, like you said, it could just be practice in your head. You just go, oh, this is practice. And so I'll even give an example. I did there was a podcast idea. Someone from the Proto ATL came up to me and said, hey, do you want to do this Design 75 thing? I don't know if you guys were approached by him. I can't remember his name, but it never came out, right? But it forced me to sit down and record myself making a game from prompts in 75 minutes.
Wow.
And And the thing that I learned about it was I don't like that format. So that's one thing. Because you're just trying to talk out loud through your process, which was me just looking at the internet, which is most of my process for trying to figure out how to start. But it also taught me that bad prompts, like, oh, so here, I'll give this Daniel.
Oh boy, here we go. All
insects,
right.
Insects and combat.
Okay.
Go. but like, I don't like combat in games. Mm-hmm. And same thing as yourself. It's kind of like I immediately went, oh, well, that's one of the prompts, but I'm never going to use that. So, yeah, I'm just going to make a game that doesn't include combat.
Well, I mean, there's still value in doing it, at least in recognizing, okay, so clearly we don't care for certain elements of certain games, but a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. And there is probably something valuable to learn from that, even if superficially there's something inherent in those themes or mechanics that we don't care for ourselves. So it's still valuable to stretch outside of that comfort zone a little bit. Though personally, I actually quite like prompts. They rarely lead to anything like final for me. Like it's hard for me to take a prompt and get it all the way to completion. A friend of mine and I, a long time ago, Fred Hicks from Evil Hat Productions, we had this long running thing for a while where we played a what we call pitch tag, where we would come up with a title, and one of us would come up with a title. The next person. So say I came up with the title, and he would take that title and come up with a game description of it, some kind of game product. He's on the publishing side, so he leaned a little bit more on the role-playing game side. Then he would toss me a title that he'd just come up with, and then I would come up with something, and usually that leaned more on the board game side of things. Sometimes there's some variance here. One time I pitched the title Dinocalypse, and that ended up becoming a three-novel trilogy published by Evil Hat Productions called Dinocalypse. It's like Dinocalypse Now, Dinocalypse Forever, and like, but yeah, it was like dinosaurs. It's what you expected. It was a dinosaur themed apocalypse. But we kept documentation of our entire pitch tag process, and so you can go back into my blog and just search for pitch tag, and you'll just find at least 100 half finished, unformed, weird ideas that are just never going to get anywhere in particular, but they're fun for loosening up. They're like a stretching exercise before you actually hit the mat and start doing some real serious stuff. And that's still valuable too. I don't know if that so much counts as a booster rocket itself, since it's not really. I think the core metaphor of this whole thing is something that has been made. You made a thing, but it's not going to make it to the final production or whatever your ultimate goal is. It's not going to be included in that final package. So like a quick, pitch brainstorming session is fine and all, but that is definitely practice. But if we're going to narrow this definition down a little bit more, I would think that there would be a physical artifact as a result of this. That would be the booster rocket, so to speak.
Yeah, that's sort of thing that I think about theoretical. So on that topic, so yeah, assuming that we're talking about, yeah, something that you actually like made, at least invested some time in, let me broach the topic of your feelings, because especially it's combining this with something you said, Daniel, reminding about, the whole kill your darlings sort of idea about failing and stuff. Especially we talked about, people who are newer in design, maybe have fewer of them, either recognizing or deciding or getting to the point where someone else insists that this game that you've spent time on is probably useful as a booster rocket, but is not going to get you there. What sort of feelings have come with some of those things in the past? Does that change once you have more of them, or is it always the same?
I mean, I can talk to it quite immediately, actually. It's still a little bit raw, but so we've had to do a little bit of a end of year cleanup of the Slack channel on the guild Slack channel.
Oh, yeah.
And the way we structure our Slack channel is that each designer can make as many channels as they like for each individual prototype. And I, looking through that whole list and archiving a bunch of games that were never finished, and in some cases were co-designs, and we were actively working on them, and we were pitching them all over the place, but no one ever bit. having to face the music and just say this is probably not going to come out. And it's sad that we had to devote so much time to that and nothing really came of it in terms of it itself being published. Say in the case of Flying Taxi, we were building just these cool papercraft buildings and putting them on the table. And we learned so much about just the act of interacting with physical space on the table and how people enjoy that and how people like being able to peek around corners and having that actually matter as they try to navigate a three-dimensional space. Though the game that we made and explored that with may or may not come out in the future, I don't know. I think those are the core ideas that we came up with. There are things that will carry on into the future. Certainly, I think I'll explore 3D space again with better awareness now of what the limitations are in that design space.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect example. I remember playing that one and just the experience of like playtesting it. I learned a lot of you know, considerations about that 3D space, and that's not even me as a designer of that. So I can immediately see how that would absolutely be a thing that if it doesn't end up being published, that could definitely boost you into a better, you know, design space. Absolutely.
I would think, you know, just to comment on some of these things with like feelings for things. I think whenever I first started, I used to think that I spent so much time on something and it was hard to like, you would kind of just, even if you knew, like in the back of your mind, you're going to shelf it. Like, so I had one of my early games was called Forecaster, and it was like a weather forecasting game. And I still like the idea of making a weather forecasting game. There's something like iconically, I don't know, what is it, pastoral or nostalgic about just a weatherman or a weather, mm-hmm. Just in front of a map looking like mm-hmm. putting their hands behind them and doing things like it's just this weird, silly thing. And there was always this sense that they had to hype up their own weather forecasting and make wild predictions and things just to get people to watch. You know, it was sort of like a morning zoo atmosphere in some areas of the country. And I just love that feeling. But when you make a game like and you like the theme so much or you like something. So I made Forecaster and I really liked it. And I thought, man, I've worked on this for like a year and a half. That's a long time. And now that I've worked on games for 7 years, 4 years, 5 years, it doesn't feel like that. Like I'm like at the time I felt really invested. Now I don't feel invested at all. Like that could just be, you know, it's been sitting on the shelf for so long, and it's mainly because the mechanics are just from that period where I was just like, dice, hate you, shame you, and yeah. I'm going to make a dice game where you don't have to roll them. And and so Forecaster was interesting because it gave me one lesson, right? Like it gave me a lesson on things that were to come. I loved simultaneous actions and how they sped up gameplay. And so that taught me that variable turn order. It gave me that ability to just have someone go out of turn and figure out how that was going to work. And then also in this Forecaster thing, you could look, you kept your forecast secret, but you could look at the forecast of the person to your right. And it was always this like sense of, I know something that I shouldn't, this hidden information and this sort of social gameplay that came out of just that. It wasn't overwhelmingly social, and those things I've kept with me for like years from playing that game. Even though, like, I just don't think I'll ever return to it in the sense that I'll do the exact same thing. If I were to return to it, it would be a completely different game, mm-hmm. and that's fine. I mean, honestly, I look at that, and I look at that in like early party games I used to make. I mean, these are just things. You know, you kind of just go through phases and do things, but you don't have to ever come back to them. So I feel bad, but you know what? I'm crying about the ones that I love that aren't published yet more than I'm crying about the ones that have boosted me to where I am.
I guess if we're drawing metaphors from our personal lives, when I was doing some like more intensive marathon training, I would be sore after a lot of those long runs. But it was like, it's what they call the good hurt.
I don't understand that. That sounds like running, and that sounds like bad. I threw things in track and field. Ooh. So, you know, that I can't relate.
Yeah, I also have done a lot of sports, and yeah, there's a lot of sports analogies, but some of them even still are a little bit raw to remember, so I'll skip some of those for now. It reminds me of something you said, TC. I don't remember exactly what it was. It reminded me of this story. I assume this story is false, and I'm confident the way I tell it is going to be a little bit even more false. There's this artist, famous artist, probably given how famous Van Gogh is. I'm just going to assume it was him. And he was in this diner, probably in the 50s. He had a coffee.
Oh, yes. This story, yes.
1950s diner. All right.
He had a coffee.
So he walks into a diner.
Yeah. I think he got a coffee. He ordered his coffee black. The waitress was a classic 50s waitress. She was like, would you like some sugar in this coffee? He said, no, thank you. I like my coffee black. She said, okay. He said, wait a second. You remind me of somebody. And he said, Tim Tebow? And he's like, no. Is a famous artist. And she's like, oh, yeah, I got it. Vincent Van Gogh. He said, hey, I probably remind you of him because I am him. And she said, oh, you're a great artist. Hey, can you, like, draw me a picture? Like, just a picture on a napkin just so I can tell everybody, hey, I met Vincent Van Gogh in the 1950s diner today. He drinks his coffee black. And so Vincent Van Gogh was like, all right, I gotcha. So he, like, pulled out, you know, his case of Sharpies or whatever and starts sketching a picture on the napkin.
I'm only laughing because I know when Vincent Van Gogh actually died.
Well, I mean, he had Sharpies, right? Everybody had Sharpies.
Sure.
And, you know, he just did that in the time it took the waitress to go back in the back, bring his check, because he was just getting the coffee and he was going to leave. So, like, just a little bit of time. So she came back and was like, oh, hey, that's great. And he said, all right. I mean, is this what you'd like? She said, yeah. He was like, okay, that's $600. She said, $600? What, are you crazy? That's, it took you like 30 seconds to draw. And then he said, no, this took me a lifetime. You know, because the moral of the story is that he had so many years of experience, years of drawing things that were garbage and learning about his craft that that he could actually do something, and anything that he did was actually a culmination of a lifetime of learning. And I feel like that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think but that's something that you said, TC, reminded me of that, you know, all these things that that we do, yeah, we were invested in at the time, we threw away, no one's ever going to see. But you may not ever revisit your weatherman game, but, you know, that lifetime of thinking about weather games maybe will allow you to quickly design one that's better than anything the waitress at the 50s diner you go to has ever seen.
And it's true. It's very much true, honestly. Like, I mean, those things that I've done for a long time make it so that, you know, I would say whenever I first started, especially because I consider, like, the first published game that I did to be, like, the seventh or eighth game that I made, that, like, I mean, that's, you know, that
that's
is
a good rate.
One. Oh, it's a good rate. Okay.
Yeah, that's a good performance.
Well, I mean, and that's honestly, like, I feel like I got lucky, right? Like, I got lucky. I had a good idea and I spent 3 years on it. But yeah, I mean, I got lucky because I had a really cool idea and it sort of propelled me forward. So without, like, doing that initial Viva Java game, I wouldn't have created theories in my head about how to create game design. I wouldn't have started attending, like, game design meetups and things like that. And that sort of got me serious about things. And it was just that lucky stroke of luck that, like, seven games failed and then you get to the next one. And I would say that my luck rate has slowly gone up, that I don't have the 1 in 8 anymore. Or I mean, that's pretty that's pretty ridiculous to say. But like, I the percentage of the larger games that I do are, I'm actually better at making a larger game than I am at making a smaller game when it comes to percentages. Time wise, it's a lot easier to get lucky, like you said, with the Van Gogh and a 50s diner, like he was. That is a good example of, like, you know, you just kind of, you make this little thing and it's like, it works really nicely. And you're like, oh man, I made a really cool little thing. 10 other little things are just hard. Like, you just get thrown out because they just don't work. So I would say my percentage has gotten better over time. So if anyone's like thinking about like, oh man, this is bad. I heard at one point that Martin Wallace, he still throws out more games than he makes. I think that probably carries with pretty much everybody. I also don't understand it because, like, you kind of, well, it doesn't matter. I don't understand much of what Martin Wallace says sometimes. So probably not the best example, but at the same time, your percentage will get better. But you will still throw things out. I'm assuming, Daniel, that you're in the same boat, that there are games that you just go, oh, that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I've had some broader issues with like trying to find the energy and time to keep doing more development and design lately.
Oh, yeah.
With the new job. And I think part of that is, it's over time and getting more experience in this, I have had to be more judicious about what things I devote my energy to. And part of that is getting better about recognizing when I'm in a state of practice versus in a state of production. And it's easy to conflate the two. I can be in a state where it looks like I am doing some very, very polished final production work, but in truth, it's just practice. And I've expended quite a bit of energy and time in something that was inappropriately assigned, I think. So I've had to get better about recognizing when I'm doing which, like when I'm in which mode.
What are some tells or some things that give you a feeling that, this is just practice that you can use to differentiate earlier?
If I'm on Twitter, I've called these things like work-like activities. Usually it's something where I talk a lot about a game or a game idea. For example, this game that I've been working on, and I'm going to do it right now. This is the thing I'm talking about, is talking a lot about a game in progress feels a lot like you're working on it, but you're not actually doing it until you actually do some development. So talking about this game, being mindful that in talking about it is not actually working on it. The game is Wolfgang. The little two-player deduction game where one player is Antonio Salieri, the composer in Vienna, who is the rival, theoretically, of Amadeus Mozart. And in this game, the premise is that Antonio Salieri was also a werewolf hunter, and he strongly suspects that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart is a werewolf. And so it is up to Salieri to figure out, through deduction and clues and a little bit of card play that I'm developing through a very simple I cut you choose mechanism, Salieri offers opportunities for Amadeus to prove whether or not he's just an eccentric buffoon or if he is a werewolf that is threatening Vienna. And he has 30 days until the next full moon to figure it out. And if he doesn't, then the werewolf wins. Indeed, Mozart was a werewolf. And yeah, so like that's the pitch. And I talk a lot about it, and I talk a lot about the mechanics that I want in it. But there was a good 2 or 3 months where I was only talking about it, and I didn't do any actual writing on it. And it was only in the past weekend or so that I actually like started cracking down and working in a spreadsheet, putting some data down, getting some of these ideas, at least in writing, and figuring out how to frame them and how to phrase them. And that was, talking about it is fun and it's easy, but I had to be very careful to not let myself fool myself into thinking that was actually working on it. I feel like that's a little bit of a tangent, personally.
No, but I think it's good. Like it makes me feel good about some of my games that have been forever in the theoretical. I have the name in my head. I'm like the third race at Gravesend. And I'm like, this is going to be a game that's a heist during a horse racing, during the horse racing era. You know, it's like, it's New York City, 1908. It's got this, this is good. Like, you're going to be doing this heist in that. There's going to be three races. By the end of the third race, it'll be like a three act play. You'll get to the end of the third race and you'll have to be out of there. And the heist will have to like end at that point. And you're collaboratively working on the heist, but then also working on your own objectives as well. And if you can balance that together, you'll complete the heist, but you might not complete the heist, but you might get out, but you might not. And it's all about like, what's your motivation versus what other people's motivations are. And this game has been in my notes, written about, designed, done, like, for 5 years, I think, at this point, right? And I still don't have a playable version of it. Yeah. So I could totally understand where you're coming from in that sense. I mean, I think it's just mainly because I'll work on this every now and then, but it never becomes it comes to fruition because it's not good enough in my head. And that's sad, right? Like, that's the kind of stuff that I shouldn't be doing at this point in my design career.
It seems like that could even turn it almost into like a sandbox for you. Like, you can try something. Hey, the game's not good enough. Let me try this. You know, there's this part of that game that I do like. And so that's where you play around. So yeah, if it is a sandbox, you know, maybe over several iterations, it completely changes, but maybe that is your play area.
I mean, I have a game like that that's been that has gone through many many forms, called C-Hab, and it, loosely it was inspired by a book by it's a book called A Door into Ocean by Joan Szlonczewski. I may be mispronouncing that name, but just look for A Door into Ocean. The basic premise of it is that it's like a distant future, and it's this mostly ocean world where the humans that settled there like long, long time ago have gradually evolved to be symbiotic with the ocean planet. And it's a wild, weird thing about ecology and stuff. But some of the core ideas there were very inspiring from an aesthetic level. And I just like, and something about the aesthetics of a water world and people adapting themselves to the environment rather than trying to adapt the environment to suit them. Was very interesting to me in applying that into some kind of Euro game, where so often the game is about sort of conquering a space and taking over a space and controlling it rather than changing yourself to suit that space. And I've gone through a couple of wildly different forms for what that game could look like, from like card games to like three-dimensional worker placement games, all sorts of different stuff. And I've been chasing this like ephemeral idea of what C-Hab could be, but I've never fully committed to any one of them, even to the point of getting something printed out and put onto a table. I've gone so far as to lay out some like concepts of cards and what they could look like, put together some like stock art and stuff, but that's one of those things where it feels like you're working on it, but really not. It was easy for me to do the layout. It's easy for me to put visuals down. It's hard to actually make the game.
Is it good for us to have white whales and booster rockets?
Yeah. I think about one that the similar to what you guys are saying. There's I have this idea for a real-time game that is not a fast playing game. There's so many real-time games where real-time just means do it as fast as you can, but where like just timing works. So you have like sand timers, and the thing is that you need to, whenever you move the sand timer, you flip it over, and if it ever actually runs out, you know, the piece is dead or whatever. So you have to move it periodically, but you need to move it, you know, if they're 30-second sand timers, you know, sometime every 20-ish seconds would be okay. Maybe you're juggling five of them and you're trying to, you know, do something else with them. So it's like, it's real time, but it's not just move as fast as you can. Then it's got this like big gray area between, you know, how long do I let it sit, 20 seconds or 10 seconds or whatever, which I like the idea of, but you know, I don't like real time games. I'm not going to make that. So, so maybe just like a sandbox that I like play in that they teaches me something. Maybe that is inherently always going to be something that just falls to the planet. Who knows?
Well, I mean, it's just scientists holding up plans and looking up in the sky at that point, right? Like, it's not even a rocket. I was going to say something about, like, before, as we wind down, like, I've had moments when I've been doing the development thing now for a few years, right? Doing game development for other people. And I wanted to throw in the idea that, like, there's like this booster rocket idea, even in that, and that there are failure moments in developing other people's games that feel real bad. So, like, I'll just use the recent example. I've had this game that I didn't think was ready. Like, you know, I evaluated it, played it, didn't think it was ready for, like, prime time, and explained why to people. And they're accommodating. They're like, okay, yeah, that's cool. Well, why don't you try, you know, take it, run with it, try your ideas out. They seem pretty good. And just couldn't put it together. You know, I mean, again, it's tough because, like, this is not my own idea. This is someone else's idea. And I'm pretty much going to take their game and, like, make it like a halfway different game than what existed before. And I don't usually do that. But by the way, I just want to put this off to the side. Game development does not equal taking someone's game and making another game that you like better than their game that was there before. Your development in general should assess where the state of the game is and provide feedback so the designer and you can have, like, a good conversation on where to go. Sometimes I will take it and run with it and come back and show what I've done, but, like, it's never to try to jump outside and create a different box. This is a different type of situation. But if it pops up and I assess it as this and I get the go ahead to go for it, I want to do it. But, man, you can get stuck. And those failure moments, even with all this help, even with all these things that I've gone through before, motivation to try out something new for someone else or to get there, it's really tough. And sometimes, like in this case, I just took that game and said, hey, I failed. Let's talk about this. And that was the best thing I could have done. Even recognizing that I couldn't pull it together gave other people agency to help me. And when I reached out, they helped me. And now I have a clear path forward. So, like, don't feel bad that, like, it's not all on you. Like, these are not all, like, all the booster rockets are not all on you. But, like, in general, like, failure is a part of a process, even if you've been doing this for a long time. And sometimes failure is okay. And admitting that you're failing is fine, even when you're getting paid to fail, you know, stuff like that.
So you're saying it's not any easier, even if it's not your game.
Yeah, exactly. So even if you're working on someone else's game and going, oh, I have all these ideas, it may not pan out. Or you may be wrong. I like recognizing when I'm wrong.
Sure.
It's humbling, but, like, as much as I put on airs, I generally come back down to earth in most cases. I like to keep the ego, though, because ego is super important for an artist. artist with an E at the end.
Artiste.
Artiste.
Yeah.
Like Van Gogh in a 1950s diner.
Yeah. You could be the next Van Gogh in the 50s. That has been an excellent thing for you to say, TC. And I'm glad that you guys could come out here and we could chat. We'll wind this up. Is there anything last things you wanna fit in here before we wrap?
I can't make fun of you for getting Van Gogh's time period wrong because I got the name of the book wrong earlier. It's Art and Fear, not Art of Fear. That has the story about the 100 pounds of clay.
I was still happy to know that, like, that came from somewhere because I never remembered where that story came from. I just remembered the story.
Yeah. I think I've heard a version of that story before. Maybe it was the same one, but I also have never heard that it came from somewhere. So we're all a little bit brighter now. Thanks, Daniel, for enlightening us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I will say too, just real quick. Sometimes booster rockets can be like games that you've made that are good but not amazing. And I feel that way sometimes. I'm my own harshest critic, so I have to actually do the thing. I've turned the corner in the sense that I have to do the Steve Jobs quote where I have to say real artists ship in my head over and over and over and over again. You can't just Because if you never put a game out, technically that's practicing forever.
Yeah, yeah.
So at some point, even if it's not the greatest game that has ever been made, you do have to do, you might have to pitch it to somebody and say, hey, maybe you'd like to publish this, or, you know, publish it yourself or do something. But, you know, hey, that's where I am.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Actually, that's a good point. Given that, I guess we could extend this metaphor a little bit, just a little bit at the very end here. Because
in real artist spaceship?
Recent developments in booster rockets mean that they're reusable.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So, you know, there was a time when you'd have to completely dispose of something in order to use it. But now things can continue living on in some form or another. So, yeah, a note of hope at the end here.
What an encouraging nugget of wisdom, Daniel, that you have laid upon us.
It's a nugget of something.
All right. So, Daniel, if anyone would like to follow you or reach out to you or ask you questions about rocket ships that you seem to know way more about than we do, how could they hear from you or talk to you or whatever?
You can whatever at me at Twitter. That's at Daniel, DanielSolis on Twitter. And I tweet too much. I'm sorry.
TC, if anyone would like to communicate with you, especially to follow up on your anecdote about weather games and being a weatherman, how could they best reach you?
If you'd like to collaborate on a forecasting game that never gets published, my name is Puppy Shogun on the Twitter. That's PUPPY, but Shogun, not Shotgun. SHOGOUN, like you might think it'd be spelled. And you can talk to me about anything. I'm on Twitter pretty frequently. I'm also on Board Game Geek as the Crippled Werewolf. I guess I'll say that too. So hit me with a geek mail too if you have any questions. It's all good.
Nice. And if anyone would like me to come teach history in their high school class,
art history.
You can find me on Twitter at mmark40. I'll at least read what you say. No, I chat sometimes. All right. Well, if you want to discuss this episode or, you know, talk to us in general, we have a guild on Board Game Geek. You can go to podcast.gdofnc.com, and that will redirect you to our guild on Board Game Geek. We welcome feedback or questions or just conversations. We also have a group Twitter account that you can follow at GDofNC, which stands for Game Designers of North Carolina. And this has been another episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast. And we thank you if you listened. All right. Have a nice one. We'll catch you later.